You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 8th to the 14th of January. My name is John Elms, and today I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, books editor Karen Shook, and writer John Morgan. Universities are refusing to reveal the salary details of their senior administrative staff, a Times Higher Education investigation has found. That is in spite of official guidance that advises greater pay transparency and a recent legal ruling. Simon will bring us up to speed with that a little later. Elsewhere, a number of non-profit and for-profit private providers have formed a mission group. John Morgan has the details of that particular story. And last but by no means least, Karen will round off our podcast with an all-encompassing rundown of our jam-packed books section. But first, universities in non-disclosure of information shock. Simon, what has the THE uncovered this week?
Well, what we decided to look at was how many universities were prepared to reveal the salaries, or at least the kind of salary bands, of their highest paid administrative staff members. This kind of follows a landmark legal case last year involving King's College London, where somebody took them to the Information Commissioner to see if they would reveal all the staff members they had paid over £100,000, including academics. And the Information Commissioner originally ruled that they should, because it was in the public interest to reveal this information. King's appealed it, and in the appeal decision, it was decided that that their argument was that it was commercial sensitive information. The appeals sort of judge agreed that for academic staff that should be the case; they can keep that information secret, but for senior sort of leadership team people, anyone in the sort of vice chancellors, principals, leadership team, they should reveal kind of roughly the salary that they pay those staff. So we decided to ask lots of universities ourselves, basically, if they would reveal, in the light of that ruling, you know, how much their highest paid administrators receive. And of the 37 institutions that responded to our request, 20 declined to give details of how much senior administrators were paid. So not kind of exactly following that precedent that's been set, although, you know, it's worth saying that King's are still yet to appeal that section of the appeal, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, because they're appealing
too
second.
Confusing about how many appeals are going around.
Yeah, because they're appealing the second ruling, aren't they?
Yeah.
About senior administrative.
Exactly. So, you know, maybe the universities are waiting to see how that case pans out before that happens. But we did get some responses from others about how many staff they paid above £100,000, and in some cases, sort of more detail about who's paid what and at what sort of salary level. So you can see those details in the article.
Yeah, I'm looking through the article, I noticed that there were five institutions that didn't reveal any information at all. So clearly, going by the precedent that you suggested, that they're waiting to see the outcome of the substance, possibly.
Yep. I wouldn't like to
comment.
You suggest that, but yeah, that there may be the reason.
In the institutions that revealed everything as well, all the requests that Meme made, I seem to notice the registrar tended to be the most highly paid.
Yeah, that's
paid
true, and I mean, and probably in the traditional kind of structure of a university, I would say that after the vice chancellor, the registrar is probably would be seen as the most sort of senior officer on the administrative side, and they are responsible for you know, quite the effective running of the university in terms of student registration and lots of other administrative responsibilities attached to that. So you know, it's a pretty important role. But, you know, when vice chancellor's salaries are kind of questioned quite a lot as being excessive, then I'm sure some people will be quite intrigued to find that registrars are paid in some universities closer to £200,000.
And very interesting that Imperial, the 28 non-academic staff earning at least 100k a year, but 291 academics over 100k a year.
So they did reveal some information on that.
Intriguing.
Does that suggest? I mean, that they just got fantastic pay structures at Imperial, or that they...
Imperial are willing to pay her a lot of money to make sure they get the, in quotes, best academics.
Yeah, universities are free to set their own pay for professors. It's not part of the national pay scales. So, I mean, you can well imagine some academics in business schools on MBAs getting pretty hefty salaries, but those figures from Imperial suggest, maybe in other disciplines as well.
Maybe physicists are getting a bit of the action as well.
I mean, a big question that came up in the court case, and which is the interesting point for debate, is that, is it in the kind of interest of the public to know, how much the highest paid people in universities are earning, because, the amount of public money that goes into universities. At least one university did argue that, only sort of 30% of our money comes from the public sort of purse. But, that's still quite a sizable chunk. Interesting, actually, that LSE was one of the more compliant institutions with our request, but actually has a very low amount of money coming from the public purse compared with other institutions.
Their founders would be proud.
Absolutely. Well, that's our lead news story on pages 6 and 7, and it's got lots of figures and in-depth analysis of the matter at hand. From salaries to mission groups now, John, you have news from the private provider sector that doesn't necessarily involve scandal. What's the story?
So there's a group representing what would bill themselves as the quality private colleges that's being established and billing itself as having the potential to be a Russell Group of the alternative sector. So this group is going to represent 8 non-profit and for-profit private providers that have degree awarding powers and or university title. So part of the aim, I spoke to Alwyn Cooper, the Vice Chancellor of Regent's University London, one of the members of the new group, which held its first formal meeting on the 6th of January. And Alwyn Cooper said that part of the aim was to dissociate the members from what he called some of the very dodgy colleges still out there. He said in relation to those colleges, we're really happy for them to be hammered and hammered good, but we don't want to be associated with them.
Quite forthright words. Obviously, it would seem that the quality end of the alternative provider market, in a way, has more to fear from the bottom end dragging them down. But this is language you don't expect to hear from sober leaders of institutions.
Yeah, I think there's maybe a possibility that what's happened with some of the smaller for-profit colleges leads to tighter regulation, particularly if a Labour government comes in, they may seek to regulate private colleges more. And part of the aim for this group is to say, yes, we are quality institutions that have been through the process for degree awarding powers. Please don't, crack down on us because we've been through the same regulatory hoops as universities. But it's interesting that the group will cover both, non-profit institutions, some of them charities, as well as 3 for-profit or for-profit-owned institutions. That's BPP, owned by a big US higher education company, University of Law, owned by a private equity firm, and RDI, which is a subsidiary of another big US education firm. So, there may be some tensions within that group. Some might argue between sort of very different institutions in terms of being for-profit owned or charitable.
And certainly not, there's certainly not institutions on the whole that could say they're completely divorced of any kind of links to controversy at all. I mean, I can obviously, BPP itself has a parent, Apollo, which has been involved in controversy in the past in the US. I mean, that's not to say it's anything to do with BPP in the UK, but to kind of, it should be pointed out that, you know, it would be probably whitewashing it to say there's absolutely no question of any them having any controversial links at all. You know, there are, I think, anything when it comes to the private sector and HE, you know, that does raise prospects of difficulties in other countries and things like that. So,
absolutely, and I think that's alluded to by Alden Cooper in one of his comments, where he says, slightly ameliorates it perhaps, but saying the alternative sector is still confusing to the general public and MPs. So there's a lot known, there's a lot not known.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, part of the aim is to get better understanding, as they would see it, from politicians, particularly, you know, it's why it's forming now. It's the lead up to the general election. What's going to happen with a new government? The members of this group want to make sure they're not adversely affected by any new regulation.
I imagine the T-shirts, "We're not with them."
That's quite a good slogan. Maybe that's the tagline.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, John Storey has some really interesting points, especially if you're interested in alternative providers, which I know a lot of our readers are. Karen, what delights from the academic literature world do you have this week? I noted a particularly philosophical field to some of the books, or have I just got that wrong?
No, a couple of philosophy books in there. It's always a challenge trying to choose books for review that will appeal to our cross-disciplinary readership. There are a lot of disciplines where the really important monographs are kind of for adult eyes only, and I would say that philosophy and linguistics tend to be two of those. But I've got a few in this week. Also this week, Paul Bernal from UEA, prolific blogger and commentator, reviews Gabriella Coleman's book, Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous. Gabriella Coleman, an eminent but young academic who knows Anonymous from the inside out. Eileen Pollard reviews a book called The Unruly PhD, Doubts, Detours, Departures, and Other Success Stories. It's a US-focused book, but our reviewer thinks there are certainly a lot of very familiar stories from these personal accounts. Also this week, Lloyd Llewellyn-Jones from the University of Edinburgh was very excited about a book called Classical Masculinity and the Spectacular Body on Film, The Mighty Sons of Hercules. So swords, sandals, muscles, etc. And Kitty Stewart at the LSE reviews Andrew Dunn's quite controversial book, Rethinking Unemployment and the Work Ethic, Beyond the Quasi-Titmus Paradigm. And that's the first time I've ever said the quasi-titmus paradigm. Andrew Dunn's argument is about whether people who are on benefits, whether as many of them are being honest when they say they're not, they're genuinely looking for work and don't want to stay on benefits, as is the case. He argues that a lot of academics swallow that line too readily and should apply maybe a little more skepticism to those claims. Yes, philosophy books. Christopher Belshaw reviews Paul Snowden's Persons, Animals, Ourselves. Sharon Wheeler covers late Victorian crime fiction in the shadows of Sherlock. It wasn't all just Sherlock Holmes. And Helen Bynum covers Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, Illness, Medicine, and What Matters in the End. Obviously, he's an enormously high-profile medic in the US, academic, and someone who manages to address these issues to a wide audience and much covered. And our book of the week, reviewed by Alec Ryrie, is Benjamin Kaplan's book, Cunegonde's Kidnapping, A Story of Religious Conflict in the Age of Enlightenment. This is microhistory at its finest. It's the story of a couple in 1762 in a small bit of Holland. He was Catholic, she was Protestant. Their baby was kidnapped. And the author says that, in fact, there was too much information, not a paucity of information, when he set about unpicking the story. His area of interest is religious toleration. And he says that, although people tend to see religious toleration as something that has increased over time, if you look at early modern Europe and Holland in particular, a lot of different faith groups live together relatively harmoniously. And Alec Ryrie has nothing but praise for this book.
Fantastic, fantastic, yeah. Well, thank you very much to my fellow podcast
inmates.
Is that the question? Participants is the one I was going for. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week's issue review. But as always, you'll find comprehensive coverage in our magazine, including an intriguing interview with renowned literary theorist Terry Eagleton. Highly recommend you check that out. Don't forget, if you would like to comment on any of the content in this week's edition, you can find us on all manners of social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and of course our website, timeshighereducation.co.uk. Until then, thank you and goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.